First, we will hear from Dr. Carl Weston from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Dr. Weston is an undergraduate and medical graduate of Georgetown University. He trained in internal medicine at the Cornell Service of Bellevue Hospital and Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital in New York City, and fulfilled his military commitment as an epidemiologic intelligence service officer at what is now the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Parasitic Diseases. He received a diploma in tropical public health from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, is board certified in preventive medicine, and is a fellow of the American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene. Dr. Weston remained in the U.S. Public Health Service Commissioned Corps with postings in Nigeria during the Nigerian Civil War, in Los Angeles County, at the Pan American Health Organization Institute of Nutrition of Central America and Panama, in Guatemala City, the Virginia Health Department, and the Pan American Health Organization Caribbean Epidemiologic Center in Port of Spain, and as chief of the Pan American Health Organization Department of Communicable Diseases. He joined NIAID in 1979 as the Assistant Director for International Research. Dr. Weston currently serves as NIAID Senior International Science Advisor. Dr. Weston?
Yeah, Dr. Suk asked if I could make some introductory remarks from the vantage point of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and the infectious disease and immunology research communities. I think the main point that I'm going to make during my remarks is that NIAID's and our community's attitude towards the interaction between infections and the environment has dramatically changed over the years and is still in the process of evolution. Our institute can trace its ancestry back to the first U.S. government microbiology laboratory, which was established on Staten Island in 1887. And I think it's very appropriate that our original name was the Hygienic Laboratory, as it began to be more and more appreciated the role that microbes played in causing human disease. We very quickly became known as the National Microbiology Laboratory, and in 1948, we became the National Microbiology Institute. In the 1950s, with increasing appreciation of the importance of immunology to infectious diseases, we became the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. We're not the Immunology Institute because some polls were done and the general public did not know what immunology was, but they all knew what allergies were. The 1970s were really a critical time because that was the historical period in which the field of environmental science broke off from traditional public health with such activities of the establishment of the Environmental Protection Agency and its charge to protect human health and the environment. On the microbiology immunology side, we were also in the middle of what became known as the second biological revolution in molecular biology and immunology. And the impact that this had was it gave us the capacity to diagnose previously recognized, but also previously unrecognized microbes. And I think the key example of this was the appreciation of the HIV/AIDS virus as the cause of AIDS in the early 1980s. Meantime, we entered into the genomics and informatics revolution, which in addition to diagnosis, gave us tools to more rapidly develop treatment and prevention modalities. Other signal events for our institute were being given the lead responsibility for civilian biodefense research in 2003 following the anthrax attacks, and then in 2006, the U.S. adoption of the new international health regulations, which made our institute a part of the U.S. government's emergency response. We are the emergency research and research training response, but we are a full participant in this effort. So our current research investments are heavily oriented towards HIV/AIDS, biodefense, emerging and re-emerging microbes, immediate immune-mediated diseases, and since many of these conditions occur rarely or don't occur in the United States, we've entered very heavily into the global health arena. Our products, we hope, are the development of scientifically based new or improved diagnostic test, vaccine, drug development, and other treatment and prevention modalities. And here is our current mission. It's to conduct and support basic and applied research to better understand, treat, and ultimately prevent infectious, immunologic, and allergic diseases. Environment and sanitation are not explicitly mentioned in this mission statement. We're fairly unique at NIH in that we have the traditional NIH research and research training mandate to grow and sustain a robust basic and applied research portfolio in our priority areas. But with our civilian biodefense and emergency response, we must respond rapidly to new and emerging disease threats. And there are a great number of these emerging and re-emerging infectious disease threats. They may be newly discovered diseases, which are in red on this slide. They may be re-emerging and resurging, being heavily driven by antimicrobial and insecticide resistance, or they may, in rare instances, be due to laboratory accident or deliberate biological attack. What we've come to appreciate, and this is where our attitude and involvement in the environment is changing, is that the majority of these new and re-emerging infectious diseases which are impacting human populations have their origin in animal reservoirs and insect vectors, and that these reservoirs and vectors are heavily impacted by the environment. We're also coming to appreciate the impact of climate change on infectious diseases and the result in conditions such as increased cholera outbreaks and vector-borne diseases being impacted by climate variations. As a result, our infectious disease programs are developing much more of an environmental focus. One of the earliest ones was back during the Clinton administration when there was an initial government concern at climate change, and there was an interagency domestic study that was done. It did not include health, but by the time the international component was made, it did include health, and we had a very productive interagency agreement with the EPA to do some modeling on the likely impact of the climate change on health. We were also given a congressional mandate for the inner city asthma research studies. And with the renewed concern about pandemic influenza, we have established a network of centers of excellence in influenza research and surveillance, the CEIRS program, which do not just work in human, they conduct environmental biologic surveillance in aquatic birds, domestic animals, to identify influenza viruses with pandemic potential. And the program has moved into the search for these influenza viruses in wild birds and viral ecology and viral hosts. So where we are going now is trying to achieve the ability to predict and prevent the next epidemic before it happens, and in addition to identify pathogens that have the potential to appear and reappear. And I think since we have not been strong in the environmental area, we need to strengthen our relationship with environmental research partners and engage research partners across different disciplines and fields, particularly the veterinary, agriculture, and environmental partners. So here is the contact information for any of you who may have questions or want to follow up on the seminar. Thank you very much, and I'm going to put myself on mute.
Thank you, Carl. Appreciate it. Are there any questions? You may submit questions by using the Q&A pod you see in the lower right corner. You can also do it by your phone. While we are waiting on people to submit questions, let's go to the phone lines. Okay. If you would like to ask a question, please take your phone off of mute by pressing. Thanks. Pound six. I don't know what it is. State your name and organization and ask your question. You can mute your phone by pressing star six. Your background.
So, Carl, thank you for your presentation. This is Michelle Heacock with the NIHS. I work with Bill Sook. And I was curious, you mentioned you had some centers that were sort of situated, I'm assuming, around the United States on certain areas. Are they listed on the website, or do those areas change as emerging infectious agents come about? If you're responding, you still might be on mute.
Okay, I'm unmuted now. Yeah, you can find out about the influenza centers by just typing in CEIRS NIAID on your Google. It started out as one big center run by St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, and it had a contract mechanism. Early in our civilian biodefense research, when SARS appeared in Hong Kong and China, we supplemented that contract to do immediate SARS work. And the CEIRS network has now grown to three centers, which are run through a program project mechanism. And I think very significantly, the quick shift from influenza H5N1 to SARS has continued. And the CEIRS centers have been very active in dealing with the dengue and with the chikungunya and the Zika epidemics that are presently occurring.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Dr. Western? Okay. Seeing none, obviously you can still ask questions later on. We will get back to you and answer those questions at any point in time, even after the webinar. Okay? Thank you, Carl. Appreciate it. Going to move on to the next presentation by, we will hear Rita LaCaruso. Dr. LaCaruso is professor of toxicology in the Department of Environmental Health Sciences, School of Public Health, and professor in the program in the environment, College of Literature, Science, and the Arts at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. She directs the Michigan Life Stage Environmental Exposures and Disease Center and the Environmental Toxicology and Epidemiology Training Program. She also leads a project as part of the Northeastern University Superfund Research Center, the Puerto Rico test site for exploring contamination threats. Her current research focuses on identifying chemical and pathogen risks for preterm birth, understanding mechanisms that underline how such exposures impart risk to pregnancy, and advancing interventions to reduce or prevent adverse pregnancy outcome. Dr. LaCaruso received her PhD in toxicology from the University of Cincinnati. Dr. LaCaruso, you're up.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Bill, for that introduction, and thanks to whoever is out there listening who has tuned in to hear this talk. Well, I will be the one that is speaking today. I do want to draw your attention to the fact that my co-presenter here listed is Erica Boldenow, and that's because the data that I will be presenting in today's talk is part of Erica's doctoral dissertation from when she was a graduate student in my laboratory. In addition, we could not have done this work without our collaborators, Drs. Aman Hassan, Mark James, and Chuan Wuxi. So let's see if I can advance this, and it works. It worked. Okay. Actually, I want to go back because it's hard for us to imagine a person who is more vulnerable than the individual that's shown in this title slide. This is a preterm birth infant held in the hand, and you know, it's very hard to think that we could be any more vulnerable than that. In fact, we are assaulted. We are under constant challenge to resist infection from microorganisms every day in our lives, whether they're bacteria or fungi or viruses. And it's important that we maintain an immunological defense against infection by these microorganisms. So it's been recognized that chemicals and chemical contaminants in the environment can interact with pathogens in such a way that the chemicals either modify the pathogens or they modify the hosts, us, and resulting in a change in our susceptibility to being infected and harboring an infection when we encounter these pathogens. There was a commentary written subsequent to the first quote by Drs. Birnbaum and Young, published in the Environmental Health Perspectives in 2010, in which they basically said, it's about time that toxicologists began to consider interactions of chemical contaminant exposures with these infectious microorganisms in trying to understand how environmental contaminant exposures may be impacting health. My research is primarily focused on preterm birth. Preterm birth is a very important public health concern. It's expensive, it's emotional, it has lifetime consequences for the offspring, and it impacts families tremendously. This is a CDC image taken here showing that in 2012, one in every nine babies were born preterm in the United States, showing its prevalence. As Dr. Sook said, I am a project leader in the PROTECT Superfund Research Center, and our center is particularly interested in studying preterm birth in Puerto Rico. This graph shows, I'm trying to figure out how to do the arrow here, this graph shows the percent, the rate of preterm birth in Puerto Rico, shown here by the yellow squares, over a 21-year period from 1990 to 2011, and compares that to the average preterm birth rate in the United States, shown below. And it's clear that preterm births are much higher in Puerto Rico compared with the United States on average, and that it exhibited a marked increase sometime around the 1997 or so. So I'm interested in work I'm going to present today we are interested in looking at asking the question whether exposure to toxicants, in this case trichloroethylene, and pathogens, in this case Group B streptococcus, can interact in a way that modifies susceptibility of a pregnant woman to infection, and that that infection could possibly then translate into adverse birth outcomes. We chose to work with trichloroethylene because it is a common industrial solvent, because it was widely used in industry. It is a common contaminant in Superfund and hazardous waste sites. Because it's a common environmental contaminant, it's also a relatively common drinking water contaminant. In 2014, it was reclassified as a known human carcinogen. It has known developmental toxicity with neurotube defects and cardiac defects associated with its exposure. And most importantly and relevant for the research I'm going to be talking about is that it has immunotoxicity. It is linked to autoimmune diseases. It has been, exposure to trichloroethylene has also been shown to hamper or damp down release of cytokines. And this is important because these cytokine responses can be critical components of our first defense, the so-called innate immune defense, when we encounter pathogens. And very relevant to the topic is that in a mouse study, exposure to trichloroethylene increased the susceptibility of the mice to infection from the bacterium and increased the mortality of those mice. That is the likelihood that they died when they got infected with the bacterium. The map on the right here, this is a map of the main island of Puerto Rico, and it just shows known Superfund and hazardous waste contaminant sites. And because trichloroethylene is a common contaminant of these sites, it's relevant to the PROTECT mission. Trichloroethylene's toxicity is known to be dependent on its metabolism, and trichloroethylene has two major pathways of metabolism. The most common pathway the best known pathway of trichloroethylene metabolism is the one that predominates in the liver, and that is the CYP or the P450 oxidation pathway that results in the toxic metabolites trichloroacetic acid and dichloroacetic acid. But predominant in the kidney is an alternate pathway which involves glutathionylation. And this is particularly interesting because some of you may know that glutathione, this small peptide, tripeptide, is usually thought of as a defense against reactive metabolites and against DNA damaging agents, for example. But in some cases, glutathionylation, or the attachment of a glutathione moiety to a toxicant, results in its bioactivation, and that is what happens with trichloroethylene. So the metabolite that we are particularly interested in is this 1,2-dichlorovinylcysteine, or DCVC, which is further bioactivated by beta lyase in the kidney to form a very reactive metabolite. And we decided in our work we are working with the metabolite instead of with the parent compound because we are using an in vitro system. It's important to consider when studying preterm birth the role of infection, and the reason is because infection is one of the strongest etiological factors associated with preterm birth. And in this Lancet review, it was estimated that 30 and even as high as 50% of preterm deliveries are related etiologically to maternal or fetal infections. I'm sorry, I keep clicking my mouse and it doesn't forward the slides. It just moves the arrow. So sorry about that. Infections contribute to neonatal deaths as well. Preterm birth complications are the the thought to be the largest contributor to neonatal deaths, but neonatal infections are very high also, and these may be occurring after birth or often, as in the case of group B strep, can occur when a baby is delivered through an infected birth canal. So group B streptococcus is in fact the bacterium or the microorganism that we decided to work with as a model microorganism in this first study of toxicant pathogen interactions in relation to gestational tissue infection. It's a gram-positive bacterium, and we are interested in it in part because it is a common colonizer of the female reproductive tract. It's estimated that as many as 30% of women have their female reproductive tract colonized by group B strep. It is considered a leading cause of infectious neonatal morbidity, that is disease and mortality, death in the United States. It's associated with poor birth outcomes that include preterm birth and low birth weight. This is a schematic that shows the fetus in the womb during pregnancy, and I'm going to walk you through some important parts of it to understand, so that you understand our in vitro model and why we think the response we see in our in vitro model may have relevance. So this shows the fetus in the womb, and here is the placenta. And emanating from the placenta is the gestational membranes or the extraplacental membranes. And these form the gestational compartment. These are the membranes that break in the breaking of waters with the onset of parturition or labor. They play a very critical role, these membranes, in protecting the fetus and the gestational compartment from infectious microorganisms that can migrate from the vaginal canal through the cervix and into the uterus, and they then encounter this extraplacental membrane, these microorganisms. And so that membrane forms a physical barrier for microorganisms and also forms an immunological barrier against these pathogens. These membranes are really fascinating tissue because they are composed of cells derived from the fetus that makes up the amnion and the chorion portion of the membranes. They are also composed of cells that are derived from the mother, from the lining of the uterus, and these are the decidual cells. The myometrium, of course, is also of maternal origin because this is the uterine muscle that forms the outer portion of the uterine cavity. So we actually are studying in our model the extracellular, extraplacental membranes. When the gestational tissues encounter an infectious microorganism, those infectious microorganisms elicit an inflammatory cascade, usually beginning with binding to and activation of toll-like receptors. These then lead to the induction of expression and release of pro-inflammatory cytokines, which are part of that critical first defense, that innate immune defense in helping us to fight infections. These include pro-inflammatory cytokines like interleukin-1 beta, TNF-alpha, interleukin-8, and interleukin-6. These lead to the release of prostaglandins. They lead to the release and activation of matrix metalloproteinases and to the recruitment of white blood cells to the membranes, such as macrophages and neutrophils. The macrophages and neutrophils actually further amplify the pro-inflammatory cytokine response. And together, these mediators then bring about the three things that are necessary for labor. We need to have contractions of the uterus. This is the myometrial contractions, largely stimulated by the prostaglandins. We need the rupture of the membranes or the breaking of the waters, and this is the result of two things, primarily the activation of the matrix metalloproteinases, which degrade the collagen in the amnion and thereby weaken the sac. Also, there seems to be a role for cell death or apoptosis in that process. And then finally, the cervix has to ripen. That is, we have to have a breakdown of the collagen in the cervix so that it can dilate to allow the baby to pass with the contractions of the uterus. The hypothesis of our study is that the trichloroethylene metabolite dichlorovinylcysteine decreases innate immune response of gestational membranes, thereby increasing host susceptibility to infection. For our experiment, we acquired gestational tissues, the membranes, the extraplacental membranes, from non-laboring cesarean section deliveries. We had two types of culture conditions we used. In one, we have the tissue punch cultures. This is where we first blunt dissected the choriodecidua from the amnion. That simply means the amnion has a lot of collagen in it, so it's really pretty tough. We can pretty much just pry the tissues apart. That's all blunt dissection means. Then we take a tissue punch and we punch 12 millimeter diameter tissue punches and floated them in culture. The second model that we used is a transwall culture model, and here we use the full thickness membranes that includes the amnion and chorion decidua. And here in this one, we mount the tissue on a frame of a transwell device and insert. Usually these transwell inserts come with a synthetic membrane on their bottom because they're used for co-culturing cell types. But in our case, we get them from the manufacturer without any kind of a membrane on the insert. And we simply take the tissue, we gently stretch it across that insert. We take a latex band that's used from a dentist from braces, that are used in braces and they're sterile, and we use that to hold the tissue onto the insert, trim away excess tissue, and then we can place them into culture wells, and this creates a two-compartment model system in vitro that mimics the in vivo separation of the two compartments of the inside and outside of the gestational compartment. We allow 24-hour acclimation, then we add GBS, and we use GBS strain A909. So here's some of the data. I'm not going to present all the data because I was told I had 20 minutes for a presentation. So I probably could have put more data in, but here's what, so these are the main results that we found from our study. First on the left, you can see that this shows, oh, I forgot to put the legend on. There's DCVC shown here in the top line. And then whether there is GBS present here on the right side of each graft or absent on the left side of each graft. And what you can see is that DCVC by itself did not stimulate, in transwell cultures, did not stimulate release of TNF-alpha. But GBS elicited a very strong response of release of TNF-alpha. And this is TNF-alpha measured in the membrane, measured in the media. And when we looked at the amount of TNF-alpha that was released by these tissues with GBS in the presence of DCVC, what we found was that 5 and 10 micromolar DCVC were effective in completely blocking the release of GBS-stimulated TNF-alpha from these tissues. Similarly, with IL-1-beta, we see that the DCVC alone had no effect. GBS alone elicited a strong response, and that 5 and 10 micromolar DCVC were able to block the GBS-stimulated response in these transwell cultures. This just shows for two more cytokines. This is IL-8 on the left side, again showing that the DCVC alone did not increase the release of IL-8, but GBS alone increased the release, and this increased GBS-stimulated increase was blocked by 5 and 10 micromolar DCVC. The IL-6 release, although we saw some trends, these were not statistically significant. In other experiments, we used lipoteichoic acid, or LTA, as a surrogate for GBS infection. This is commonly used in some experiments where it might be difficult to work with the whole bacterium. Sometimes these cell wall components, like LPS for gram-negative or LTA for gram-positive, are used as a surrogate for infection. And this just shows that the on the left, that the DCVC inhibited, as did the GBS, DCVC shown on the right side at each time point, 4, 8, and 24 hours, that the DCVC in a concentration-dependent manner inhibited GBS-stimulated release of TNF-alpha. That's the clear bar. So it's very similar to what we just saw for GBS. But what's new here is on the right side showing that the LTA stimulated the expression of the messenger RNA for TNF-alpha. So this is appears to be working at the level of the gene transcription. LTA increases the expression of TNF-alpha, and DCVC at 10 micromolar prevented that LTA-stimulated expression of mRNA for TNF-alpha, suggesting, as I said, that this is acting on the level of gene transcription. And these experiments, in addition to using LTA as a surrogate for GBS infection, they were also performed in the tissue punch cultures instead of in the trans wells. So to sum it up, what our data suggests is that group B, what our data show is that group B streptococcus, when applied to gestational tissues in culture, extraplacental membranes in culture, in the presence of this trichloroethylene metabolite, we had a little bit of a translation problem from widescreen to non-widescreen here. Trichloroethylene metabolite DCVC blocks release of certain innate immune defense factors. It's kind of hard for me to visualize it, so here she is. That's her innate immune defense. And it's being inhibited by the DCVC, and specifically what we saw was decreased TNF-alpha, IL-1-beta, and IL-8. And the question is, does this then translate to adverse birth outcomes? And further work is needed to determine that. So I only showed you a portion of the data. These are first experiments. I'm not aware of any other experiments where they looked at toxic and pathogen interactions in relation to infection of gestational tissues. And so these are our first experiments. They're published in this paper shown at the top. I want to acknowledge that various people in the lab do various things to help us with this work. It's hard to do it all by ourselves, that we've been generously funded by the Superfund Research Program, as well as NIAID. Thank you to our former speaker. And NIEHS, as well as through the Gates Foundation through the Global Alliance for the Prevention of Prematurity and Stillbirth. If you're interested, we also have some related publications that describe other types of research we've done with group B strep in the publications that are shown there. All right. So thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, Rita. We do have a question, and I'm going to read the question. And okay. So the question, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you great.
Okay. The question is the increase in preterm births in Puerto Rico the result of less miscarriages and better health care?
All right. So if I understand it, so what the question implies is that there are more preterm births because babies that would have been lost due to a miscarriage or spontaneous abortion are now surviving to later in gestation so that they're born viable. Would that be a correct assumption?
That would be my assumption by that, yes.
Okay. And I don't have the data for that. Actually, when Jose Cadero speaks, he is more, I think, plugged into the epidemiology on that. But my understanding is that that has not been identified as an explanation for the rise of preterm births in Puerto Rico.
Thank you very much. And I think Jose can probably answer that question when his turn comes up. I have another question. Since the
DCVC?
Yeah, TCVC metabolite of perchloroethylene is even more toxic than DCVC, would you expect TCVC to also result in blocking TNF-alpha release, increased susceptibility to GBS infection?
I'm not sure I got all of that. I think, so I'm looking at the, I pulled up the the metabolism. So say that the, I'm not sure I got it, the question. Can you repeat it?
Do the best I can. Since the TCVC metabolite of perchloroethylene is even more toxic than the DCVC, would you expect the TCVC also result in blocking TNF-alpha release, increasing susceptibility to GBS infection?
Okay.
Because one is more toxic than the other. Do you expect that? Yeah, you got it.
Right. I think I got it. I think what the question is asking is comparing perchloroethylene or tetrachloroethylene to trichloroethylene. I think I was thrown off by the TCVC, but I think that's what the question is after, and is whether do I think a similar mechanism may apply for a similar solvent, the tetrachloro or perchloroethylene. And I think, yeah, I think it's possible. I think we need to definitely be looking looking at that. We think that oxidative stress for reactive oxygen species has some important roles. We've shown that the DCVC generates ROS. I didn't put that on those slides. Actually, it's further reading. I didn't even think of that. But that DCVC increases ROS generation. We have new data that show that it seems to be working at the level of the mitochondria. Perchloroethylene, tetrachloroethylene has many of the same mechanisms, often at lower concentrations. So I think it would be an interesting thing to test. I think it's likely.
Okay, great. Thank you. Another question. What data are available to demonstrate the concentration used in your in vitro models are comparable with DCVC, human blood, or amniotic fluid?
That's a great question. And actually, so there's no data on DCVC, but there is on its precursor, DCVG, which is the 1,2-dichlorovinylglutathione, and this one. And Larry Lash did a study of workers exposed to trichloroethylene and measured, I think it was 30 micromolar in the blood. Anyway, we're well within it. And that's the immediate precursor to DCVC. So I don't think we're far off the mark. Also, when you look at in vitro studies with the putative carcinogenic target, which is the kidney tubular epithelial cells, and you look at those in vitro studies, they rarely see responses at concentrations as low as what we see. And yet it is the effect of DCVC on those kidney tubule cells which is responsible for trichloroethylene being reclassified as a known human carcinogen. So I think that we're not too far off the mark.
Thank you. A couple more questions here. Are there future studies planned as to finding the gaps that you have in your data that you would need to test to solidify adverse health effects connection? Essentially.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And this is just at the start, and we did have some interruption in some of our work with personnel turnover, but we did not show even yet whether the effect translates into infection of the GBS into the tissue, and that's the next experiment that we are currently working on now. Yeah, there's a lot of gaps. And I'd like to take it into an in vivo mouse model. So I have a collaborator who has an in vivo GBS infection mouse model with pregnant mice. And I think we could take some of our work into that.
Great. You obviously got a lot of questions here. So.
Oh, good.
Did good.
That means they didn't fall asleep and they didn't hang up.
is the sulfoxide involved in toxicity, and could that be related to the lack of FMO3 expression in the fetus?
I don't know.
Good answer.
I would suspect, but I don't know.
Good answer. It's always important to know what you don't know. Okay, a general question, unrelated to this research. Involved.
Well, that's always fun.
you might know the answer to it. Involves the existence of any research on the effect poor diet plays on immune system prevention of chemical impacts. Essentially, what role does the diet play in preterm births and in these studies?
Okay. Well, that's not too far-fetched, really, Afield, because one of our main thrusts of our research is looking at the generation of reactive oxygen species and what kind of a role that plays in responses to exposures to chemical contaminants. That's how we started, was looking at just chemical contaminants, but now also we're interested in the GBS and the interactions with the GBS. The studies are not overwhelming or unanimous, but there is a suggestion that, for example, supplementation with N-acetylcysteine can have benefits, and that's an antioxidant, and there are, okay, so I guess the question was about diet. I'm talking about supplements, which isn't really the right answer. But I think that a well-rounded diet that is healthy, contains a balanced component of nutrients, is the best for pregnancy. And I'm not an epidemiologist, so that's why I went right to the supplements in my answer. But that's the best I can say. I suspect it's very important.
Okay, good. One last question before we move on. Are DCVC adducts detected in target tissues?
Oh. It's the downstream metabolite. And yes, there are adducts that have been detected, but I can't say beyond that.
Good.
So it's the beta lyase, the beta lyase acts on the DCVC to make the reactive metabolite. And those adducts have been detected. They do bind to basically, I think, any macromolecule, including DNA.
Okay, great. As I mentioned before, if any other questions arise after or during the session from this session, just go ahead and email us or give us a, you know, ask us the questions, and we'll get back to you. Again, Dr. LaCaruso, thank you very much. I totally enjoyed your presentation.
Well, thank you.
Our next presenter is Dr. Jose Cordero. He will briefly introduce his work of basically the Northeastern Superfund Research Program PROTECT Center, which is something that Dr. LaCaruso mentioned before. He will briefly introduce their ongoing work on the Zika virus in Puerto Rico. Dr. Cordero is the Patel Distinguished Professor of Public Health and Chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics in the College of Public Health at the University of Georgia. Previously, he served for 27 years in the U.S. Public Health Service at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention as Assistant Attorney Surgeon General of the Public Health Service, and also held other positions focused on improving the health of mothers, children, and adults in various programs. He retired from CDC as the director of the National Center on Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities. He served for 8 years Dean of the School of Public Health, Dean of the University of Puerto Rico School of Public Health before joining the University of Georgia. His research focuses on the health of mothers and children in specific risk factors for preterm births and preconception approaches to improve pregnancy outcome. Dr. Cordero is the co-director of the Puerto Rico Test Site for Exploring Contamination Threats, again otherwise known as PROTECT, funded by the NIEHS Superfund Research Program and the Center for Research on Early Childhood Development, Exposure and Development, a Children's Environmental Health Centers program. Dr. Cordero is an investigator in the Zika in Pregnancy Consortium study in Puerto Rico. Dr. Cordero.
Oh, thank you very much. And I will be just spending about 5 minutes describing what we are doing on Zika in pregnancy. And the reason that we are engaged is that we were one of the a few sites funded by NIH conducting the recruitment of a large cohort study of pregnant women. And Puerto Rico becoming one of the places, and it's not the epicenter of Zika in U.S. soil, we were asked to help develop a cohort similar to what we have done for PROTECT. You already heard about, and we certainly wanted to be able to help in these serious public health problems that we're facing in Puerto Rico, most Latin America, and also in part of Asia, and that we already have some transmission within the state in Florida. So the Zika in pregnancy study, if we go to the next slide, it's a consortium of five countries and 9 sites, and what we intend to do is to recruit 10,000 pregnant women in the course of 2 years. And in Puerto Rico, we have 2 sites, and we expect to recruit about 1,000 pregnant women within those 2 years. What we're doing is recruiting pregnant women before gestational age, 14 weeks, and we follow them to delivery. And the baby will be followed for at least 2 years. Our eligibility criteria is pregnant women that are 15 years or older. And as we can see in the next slide, the reason for the cohort is that to actually understand some of the key issues of a Zika infection. And Zika itself, it's a mild infection in adults, but the main problem is the risk it poses to the fetus. And the birth defects and neurodevelopmental abnormalities that have been seen in these infants that have been infected during pregnancy are fairly severe. So the key questions for this study is to find out what is the risk, be able to measure the risk of infection with Zika in pregnant women. There is evidence that in some infections, especially influenza may be a good example, there are significant differences in terms of the risk and severity that influenza poses to pregnant women. So one question is, do we have something similar in terms of the risk of infection among pregnant women? Once, if you have someone that is a mother that is infected, what is the risk of infection to the fetus? And if the fetus is infected, what is the risk that fetus would have serious birth defects? Okay. We really don't know. We know that it occurs, but we really still don't have good data on the risk. Zika is an infection that in 80% of infected individuals, it's asymptomatic. So another question that is important to address is whether the risk to the mother or the fetus is different if it's asymptomatic versus symptomatic. Also from known work in terms of teratogenesis, there's always differences in terms of the risk, whether it's first, second, and third trimester. And that is something else that we would like to quantitate. If we go to the next slide, there are also a few other questions that are also important, that because we are doing a cohort study, we would be able to answer and we would like to address. And they include, how long does Zika virus is present in body fluids? There's some evidence that Zika can remain, for example, in vaginal fluids for several months. And what is the range? It is not known. We hope that with this cohort, we would be able to get a range of how long does the virus stays in body fluids. And we're collecting samples for both vaginal and saliva, aside from blood and urine. And another question that we'll be exploring is what are the risks for neurodevelopmental defects among babies infected in pregnancy, whether they have serious birth defects or not. Recently, a meeting was held at NIH where many of the colleagues that have been following infected babies in Colombia and Brazil reported on the risk or some level of risk for infants that appear completely normal but appear to have an increased risk for epilepsy and other neurodevelopmental adverse outcomes. And a key question for us is also, do environmental exposures interact in the risk to the mother and the fetus? And particularly, there have been questions raised about pesticides and perhaps endocrine disruptors. And that would be another question that we'll be addressing in this study. If we could go to the next. Just to give you a little bit of detail on how we're going to follow pregnant women that participate in this study. We recruit them, as I mentioned earlier, about less than 14 weeks, and then at the initial visit when they're recruited will be collecting blood samples to, and they will be used for whole blood, for serum, for plasma, and also urine, and as well as vaginal fluids and saliva. We would determine in that first visit whether there is evidence of a previous Zika infection, and so we will be able to classify the cohort in terms of those that already had been infected and those that have not. And then on monthly visits, we would collect urine and saliva, and in between, about every 2 weeks, a urine sample. the idea is that we could detect as early as possible if there is a new Zika infection. We will have a detailed data collection in terms of pregnancy course during the second and third trimester. And at birth, we'll be collecting a cord blood and placenta. And in some of the sites, we would be able to collect any products of conceptions in terms of pregnancy losses and stillbirth. And we hope that following the collection of and completion of pregnancy for nearly the 10,000, we would be able to answer many, if not all, the questions that are that actually we have been posting. So that, in a nutshell, is what our Zika in pregnancy study is, and we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Jose. I appreciate it. It was very good. So are there any questions? If there are any questions, you know, again, use the Q&A pod. You want to open up the phone lines, you can do that. As a reminder, please take your phone off of mute by pressing #6. You can re-mute your phone by pressing *6.
Bill, well, there may be some sending some questions. Let me answer the question that was posed to Rita about,
thank you.
And I think the question was about miscarriages and also about issues related to healthcare. Actually, one of the reasons that we actually developed PROTECT is that prior to that time, we actually did a very detailed analysis looking at risk factors for preterm birth in Puerto Rico. And what we learned was that even though we had a major improvement in terms of access to prenatal care, where we went from about 60% to nearly 85% of pregnant women that were having their first visit in the first trimester. And even though we actually went to about 95% of pregnant women having a health insurance, and so a major decline in the use of tobacco during pregnancy. And we have had no significant increase in the rate of twinning, which mostly is due to assisted reproductive technology or multiple birth. So while all those things were improving, all those factors were improving, our rates were going higher and higher. And Puerto Rico has actually the highest density of Superfund recognized sites per square mile than any other jurisdiction in the in U.S., and especially in the North Karst area where we are conducting the PROTECT study, we have a huge density of contaminated sites. So that's why we're focusing on environmental factors.
Thank you. That was very good. I appreciate you jumping back up to that question. So a couple other questions came in. So with regards to your entire study thus far, when do you expect results?
You know, we are aiming at having the first results in terms of infections in pregnancy and outcomes that could be based on newborns and through prenatal diagnosis in the course of the next 2 years. But in terms of neurodevelopmental outcomes, I think we're talking about 2 to 5 years to have the earliest reports.
Okay, great. Thank you. So, next question. How will the sample size vary as we move along in eradicating the mosquitoes with those robust efforts that are taking place?
I wish I could say that there have been significant robust efforts to control the vector, but these studies have been conducted in Brazil, Colombia, Central America, and Puerto Rico, And I would say that there have been some efforts in vector control, but so far could not say that they're going to be, they have been very impactful. As I say that, yes, in the Florida area, I think between aerial spraying and what they're doing in house to house, I think they've demonstrated the significant impact in reducing transmission. But we have not seen that in the Latin American countries or Caribbean and Puerto Rico, Central America. Having said that, I think this is an infection that actually goes to attack rates about 80%. It's happening and may have and already happened in Colombia is that from having a very large epidemic curve, it has moved to more becoming an endemic infection with low levels and low rates as the more susceptibles are accumulated. I'm saying all that, but also saying that, for example, in Puerto Rico, from what we see in some of the modeling work, we are still probably in the first third of the epidemic curve, and so we should have quite a bit of cases that actually have not been infected that will be followed, which is what's going to determine what sample size we need to be able to detect an effect.
Okay, great. Thank you. Another question. What are some of the environmental exposures you'll be looking at in the study?
I'm sorry, the environmental exposures?
Yes. I'm assuming okay. The chemical exposures, yeah.
Yeah. The first one is pesticides. There already have been some concerns raised whether there might be if pesticides may be a factor. And the second is we're looking at some endocrine disruptors like phthalates and others. There are different kinds of pesticides that are used in different countries. And so we are at the early stages of defining what kind of testing is done in the different participating sites. But I would say that pesticides is where we're going to be looking as a primary question.
Great, thank you. Will there be continuous monitoring of the infectivity and virulence of Zika viremia corroborated with routine blood, saliva, and clinical management of these enrolled patients?
Yes, and part of the protocol is that regardless of the time that when they're infected during pregnancy, we will continue to collect samples. And part of the questions that we want to answer is for how long the virus will continue to be circulating. We hope and expect that we'll continue. If those that actually are still circulating or shedding the virus or detectable in any body fluid, that we continue to do that even after delivery.
Okay, thank you. At what stage in the Zika epidemic are we? There's two more parts to this question.
Right. I think it depends on what country are we talking about. In Brazil, in several of the sites, actually are moving into the endemic situation because they already have most of the population infected. In Colombia, also we are at that stage. In Guatemala and Nicaragua, which are the other sites, I don't think that's clear because they have a lot more seasonality than, say, we have in Puerto Rico. We have in Puerto Rico, basically, mosquitoes circulating all year round. From what we have seen in terms of the surveillance for Puerto Rico, we are about maybe a third to 30 to 40% towards the epidemic, and based on two measures. One is a fairly active surveillance, but also measuring a PCR based a detection for blood donors, which actually measures asymptomatic, and it has. This is done on a weekly basis, and it has continued to increase. We started like at 0.2%, and now we are at 2%, and it continues to increase.
Great. Two more questions, actually. How are the collaborations with NIAID efforts in place to utilize the ongoing vaccine development project? Maybe you don't know the answer to this one.
I'm not sure I know the answer to that. I know that there is some sites that are but no, I'm not that familiar with that.
Okay. All right. There's one question here from the audience here.
Hey, Jose, thanks for your talk. This is Michelle Heacock again. I could see there's some animal studies that are showing that the progenitor cells might be targeted in adult brains.
Uh-huh.
Your study can address this, or what your thoughts are. You may have to answer this online, but if you can answer it quickly, it'd be great.
Well, yeah. Well, actually, we have some evidence of that already because, Puerto Rico, the CDC is conducting active surveillance for Guillain-Barré, which is a known complication, and clearly the risk of Guillain-Barré among those that have sick infection, it's about a case for every 2,000 infected, which is much higher than what you see, say, from influenza. So that's one point where there is some evidence of that. In terms of studies looking at other kind of neurologic impact on the adult brain, I'm not familiar, but certainly that is a concern. And not sure, maybe you know or others know about studies that may be being conducted specifically for that.
Great. Thank you very much. In the interest of time, we're on. Those folks who've asked questions, we will address those questions electronically. And but I want to thank you, Jose,
for
your efforts here. We're really informative. Thank you. So I'm going to move on to our next presenter, which is Dr. Thomas Kensler. Dr. Kensler has received his PhD in toxicology from MIT, following postdoctoral fellowships at the University of Wisconsin and the National Cancer Institute. He joined the faculty of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health in 1980. In 2010, he joined the faculty of the Department of Pharmacology and Chemical Biology at the University of Pittsburgh. His research interests are in environmental carcinogenesis and cancer prevention. He is currently a senior editor for Cancer Prevention Research and on the editorial boards of JBC and MCB. He has received several honors, including the 2007 AACR American Cancer Society Award for Research Excellence in Cancer Epidemiology and Prevention, and the 2011 Friendship Award from the People's Republic of China, their highest award for foreign civilians. His research has been continuously funded by the National Cancer Institute since 1984, most recently by an R35 Outstanding Investigator Award. Dr. Kensler?
Thank you very much, Bill, both for the introduction and the opportunity to participate in this webinar. What I'd like to do this afternoon is to describe a very, very well-documented, certainly in perspective to the earlier talks, interaction between an infectious agent, the viral carcinogen hepatitis B virus and an environmental carcinogen, aflatoxin B1, and driving a synergistic increase in the risk of liver cancer in several parts of the world, most notably China. So liver cancer mortality is unequally spread across the globe, and here's a map from the International Agency of Research on Cancer that shows high rates in China, Mongolia, Southeast Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, and parts of Central America. Liver cancer overall is the second leading cause of global cancer death. Most deaths occur before the age of 50, and liver cancer represents about 9% of total cancer mortality across the globe. Upwards of 80% of this burden occurs in the developing world, as highlighted by that map. We know a fair bit about etiological factors. Infectious agents, both hepatitis B virus and hepatitis C virus, are very important. 500 million people are currently infected with hepatitis B virus, and 160 million or more infected with hepatitis C virus around the world. And our expectation is that there will be over 100 million deaths from liver cancer during this century. We know a lot about the etiology of liver cancer. That doesn't mean we're doing a good job of attenuating it, but we also have to recognize that these risk factors are changing and there are emerging new factors, in particular fatty liver disease. Regrettably, with liver cancer, morbidity and mortality are almost the same. You can see the number of estimated new cases annually, and it's not too distant from the mortality annually as well. Roughly 50% of morbidity and mortality from liver cancer occurs within China, and another quarter or so in East, Central, and Southeastern Asia. So those are the countries that bear the hardest burden from liver cancer, but it's problematic in other regions of the world as well. There's heterogeneity in the distribution of liver cancer, even within a country such as China. Two well-characterized hotspots, if you will, are Qidong, which is located north of the Yangtze River, north of the mega city of Shanghai, and then Guangxi Province, which is located just north of the Vietnam border in very southern China. And the red highlights here are the areas of highest risk for the development of liver cancer and mortality from liver cancer. And the greatest burden is in sort of the southeastern coastal region, which really reflects a conspiracy, if you will, of poverty and climate to drive exposures to the important viral and chemical risk factors. So what do we know about the etiology of hepatocellular carcinoma? Well, clearly, hepatitis B virus is very important, and it is the major cause of viral hepatitis in Africa and in Asia. Again, half a billion people currently infected. Hepatitis C virus has a somewhat different distribution in that it is predominant in Japan, Europe, and Southeast Asia, not China so much. And it has certainly become an emerging issue in the United States, in particular in our inner cities, where there's a lot of needle exchange and drug abuse and infection with the hepatitis C virus. I guess the good news on that front is in the last couple of years, we've developed some pretty good therapeutic interventions to attenuate some of the health risks associated with these infections. It's also clear that environmental factors can play important roles, and that'll sort of be the theme of this presentation. This includes aflatoxins, fungal metabolites found in our dietary staples, alcohol, and potentially microcystines, which are small peptide algal toxins that contaminate drinking water in various settings, blue-green algal toxins. The very important emerging factors, though, are associated with obesity, type 2 diabetes, leading to the development of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, which is clearly an emerging epidemic in the U.S. and other areas of the globe. Indeed, these are some recent NCI statistics looking at the mortality trends over the past decade. And the good news, as shown by the gray bars, is that cancer rates are dropping in the U.S., minus 1.8% annually for males, minus 1.4% in females. And this is reflected in progress in survivorship in many different cancer types. But up at the top, we see that liver cancer and intrahepatic biliary disease are drivers of increased cancer burden, 2.8% annual increase in men and 2.2% annual increase in women. So liver cancer is running very contrary to most of the successes we are seeing in the management of cancer burden in the U.S. This map just shows you the distribution of cancer rates, age-adjusted rates in the U.S., highest rates in Alaska, along the Pacific coast, if you will, along the southwest border, and then in some of the northeastern cities, reflecting probably collections of different etiologies, perhaps HCV is the driver in the northeast, hepatitis B and aflatoxin exposures in the maize-consuming regions of the southern U.S. tier, and hepatitis B virus certainly in California and up the coast, largely imported by Asian immigrants who brought this risk factor with them. HPV is also very important in Alaska, particularly in the native population there. So in the initial investigations about the etiopathogenesis of human liver cancer, the landmark study was published by Palmer Beasley in The Lancet in 1981, describing a prospective study in over 22,000 men in Taiwan, where they made the simple measures of infection with hepatitis B virus by looking at positivity for a surface antigen. And what they found was a tremendous relative risk of close to 100. And this really set the liver cancer community astir, if you will, and suggested that HPV was the key player. That may not be true, but certainly the study demonstrated the power of an immunological biomarker and understanding risks and led to some very dramatic and rapid public health responses. In particular, universal vaccination against HPV was initiated in Taiwan just a couple of years after that publication, and given the relatively small size of the island and the population of only about 16 million people at the time, universal vaccination was indeed achieved very rapidly. And this has, in fact, led to some very striking preventive outcomes in terms of reduced carrier rates for hepatitis B surface antigen, 1984 being the pre-intervention, the pre-vaccination cohort, and then you can see very rapidly over the subsequent 15 years with universal vaccination that the prevalence of infection has dropped precipitously, which is great. Some peaks, if you will, some studies have also been done to look at incidence of hepatocellular carcinoma. A busy table, but let me just highlight for you that, in fact, significant reductions in rates of HCC have been seen in birth cohorts from post-vaccination to pre-vaccination. I will point out, though, that these birth cohorts are fairly young, ages 6 to 19. Not the typical age of risk for the development of liver cancer. That's more in the 40s and the 50s, and that the total number of cases are pretty small. But nonetheless, the trends are very encouraging, and one can expect over the coming decades that the full impact of universal vaccination will become quite evident in Taiwan and other areas where this has been put in place. HPV infection doesn't appear to explain everything. Tom London at the Fox Chase Cancer Center near Philadelphia made the observations that there was substantial geographic variation in the incidence of hepatocellular carcinoma in males infected with HPV at comparable rates, suggesting that other factors must be at play. So, for example, Maori men, shown here in the triangles, men in the Gambia, West Africa, and men in Haimen, in eastern China near Shanghai, all had the same rate of infectivity with HPV, same level of seropositivity, but at least a tenfold difference in the incident and indeed mortality rates from liver cancer. And so the notion was that environmental risk factors are probably interplaying in a very important fashion here. Concurrent with these studies and largely independent were a group of investigators who were conducting observational epidemiological studies to examine the potential role of aflatoxin as a risk factor for HCC. At this time, it was well known to be an experimental hepatocarcinogen, of substantial potency. So studies were done to examine the contamination of human diets by doing market basket surveys and split bowl surveys of aflatoxin levels in foods being consumed, and then to take advantage of the cancer registries such as they existed in different countries to try and make associations between rates of HCC incidence. And in the context of China, the major foodstuffs that are contaminated are maize, corn, and peanuts and soy sauce, and to a much more limited extent, rice. So here's an aggregate of studies put together, again, by IARC investigators conducted in Southeast Asia and parts of Africa in the 70s and the 80s that show a pretty strong association between estimated intake of aflatoxin and incidence of hepatocellular carcinomas in these different communities across Africa and Southeast Asia. So causal inferences could be made, although this is clearly only an associative type of study. The really important breakthrough was a prospective nested case control study done out of a large cohort established in Shanghai, China in the mid-1980s. And this is a project that emanated out of the University of Southern California, the Shanghai Cancer Institute, MIT, as well as Johns Hopkins. And well over 18,000 urine and blood samples were collected from this cohort of healthy men aged 45 to 65. In the subsequent 7 or 8 years after this cohort was established, 50 cases of liver cancer developed in these men and were matched in about a 5-to-1 ratio with controls. Biomarkers for aflatoxin were measured, and these were both primary phase one metabolites as well as excreted DNA addict biomarkers were measured in a blinded fashion in the urine samples collected from cases and controls. And HPV infection, HPV surface antigen status was also determined in these individuals. Notably, there was a significant increase in relative risk associated with infection with hepatitis B virus, a much smaller number than was seen in Taiwan, but nonetheless a large number in epidemiological context. Those who were positive for urinary aflatoxin biomarkers also had a significant 3.4-fold increase in relative risk for liver cancer. But what was most notable was this near 60-fold increase in liver cancer risk for those that were positive for infection with the viral carcinogen as well as exposed to the environmental carcinogen. One could also see this type of interaction in what I might call geographic pathology. Here's an atlas of the township-by-township mortality from liver cancer in Jiangsu Province, which sits really is split by the Yangtze River and sits north of Shanghai. And what you can see is at least a 25-fold change in rate of liver cancer mortality across a pretty limited geographical range of a couple of hundred kilometers, again suggesting that perhaps multiple factors are at play. And indeed, the prevalence of infection with hepatitis B virus is pretty constant throughout this province. In fact, it's pretty constant throughout China, running about 8 to 10%. But we think we know at this point that aflatoxin exposures were much higher in this high-risk tip of the peninsula than in the more interior parts of this province. Studies by Kurt Harris at the NCI were looking at the importance of P53 mutations in liver cancer and many other cancers, and we all recognize that this is the most frequently mutated tumor suppressor gene in all of human cancers. And perhaps somewhat surprising, or perhaps not, there was a high prevalence of mutations of P53 in this Qidong region of China, and they were very unilaterally G to T transitions found in codon 249. So this orange pie chart here shows that 95% or more of the liver cancers that harbored mutations in P53 contained this one signature mutation, a G to T transversion at codon 249. Also a high prevalence of this mutation in Guangxi, another hotspot for liver cancer, lower rates in Taiwan, Japan, and other parts of China. This G to T transversion at 249 is really a signature mutation of aflatoxin. Aflatoxin produces the same mutation in human cells and culture, for example. So this is thought to be genetic evidence of the importance of aflatoxin in this Qidong region. Mutations are also observed in the hepatitis B viral genome. A recent study by Zhenmin Yuan here at the University of Pittsburgh identified, again using that Shanghai cohort, a greater than threefold increase in the odds ratio for mutant status of being positive for a double mutation in the hepatitis B virus. This is a mutation that exists in the X gene. It is a mutation that has been shown to increase the rate of viral replication. So this is clearly a highly selectable type of mutation that offers survival advantage to the virus. Good for the virus, bad for the host. So as we think about how aflatoxins and hepatitis interact, infection with hepatitis B virus occurs very early in life, perhaps at birth or near birth. The virus can be become integrated. It acquires mutations, not only in the X gene, but in fact now dozens of mutations are being described in the viral genome to different levels of burden. But this infectivity leads to chronic inflammation, which can trigger cell proliferation in the liver and proceeds on to chronic hepatitis in many cases and occasionally to cirrhosis. Aflatoxin B1 is a prototypical environmental carcinogen. It gets metabolized in the liver to a reactive electrophile, which can avidly interact with guanine and DNA, including at codon 249 in the human genome, producing DNA lesions, mutations in P53 in ways we perhaps don't understand, selective clonal expansion, but again also leading to chronic hepatitis and cirrhosis, which is the precursor lesion for certainly 90% or more of liver cancer in China, where this conspiracy of viral agent and environmental agent can occur. Again, we've used the biomarker tools of measuring aflatoxin metabolites in DNA addicts in the urine and aflatoxin albumin addicts out of serum samples to understand the levels and dynamics of exposures. We have tracked mutations in P53 by looking at circulating free DNA, which harbors this mutation, and in a prospective cohort study done in Qidong, we've been able to detect this biomarker upwards of 5 years prior to diagnosis of liver cancer, suggesting that it may be a relatively late event in the overall etiopathogenesis. We've also been able to track these double mutations in the viral genome and the X gene, and in some cases we've been able to detect this mutation in plasma up to 20 years prior to diagnosis, suggesting that this is a very early event as the virus evolves into a more virulent replicative infective agent. China, as you all recognize, is undergoing substantial change socially, politically, and economically, and this has provided us with an unexpected opportunity to gain further insights into the etiology of liver cancer and the interactions between virus and chemical. In the Qidong area, they established a cancer registry in 1972. This is the third oldest cancer registry in China and was the first one established in a rural area. And what this slide shows is that it's been a rather dramatic drop in age-specific mortality rates in the younger birth cohorts, essentially in individuals born in the early 1960s and more recently. 40, 50, 60% decreases in age-specific mortality relative to individuals born
You still there?
So if we can wait 1 minute, hopefully Tom may have been cut off and he's joining back on.
Are we on?
don't have a meeting. We just, I don't want to disconnect and get back on.
So we just, we've been able to reach Tom, so just hang tight. We're going to get him back on the line in just a moment. Yeah, it sounds like Tom's phone cut off, and I just talked to him, so he should be calling back in and should be on in a minute. Sorry for the delay.
Okay, so we're, as just mentioned, Tom's phone has been cut off, and we're just going to wait for him to come back on. I'm assuming... All right. In the interest of time, while we get reconnected here, I'm going to mention to you and to encourage you to join us on October 31 at 1 o'clock Eastern Time for the second session of this series, Environmental Chemicals and Immune Response. In the second session of the series, speakers will present innovative research to better understand how environmental chemicals alter immune response. Dr. Philippe Rangin, a professor at Harvard School of Public Health, will describe his work to understand how elevated exposure to perfluorinated compounds is associated with reduced immune response to vaccines. Dr. Bruce Stanton, a professor at Dartmouth College and director of the Dartmouth Superfund Research Center there, will discuss his research on the effects of arsenic on Pseudomonas aeruginosa infections in the lungs of adversely affecting, in the lungs by adversely affecting innate immune response. And Dr. Syed Hashram, professor at Michigan State University and leader of the MSU SRP Center Project, will focus on the role of the microbiome in modulating their immune system in response to dioxin exposures. So those are upcoming events on October 31st. I'm going to just keep on a roll here, okay, while we're waiting for Tom. We would also like to invite you, and we would love for you to join us, for the third and final session of this series on November 7 at 1 o'clock Eastern Time. The third session of the series will focus on interactions between environmental exposures and infectious agents in the lung. Okay.
Hello, Bill.
Yo.
My entire University of Pittsburgh system crashed, so I'm on a cell phone. I hope this
okay,
works.
Well, that's pretty exciting. We filled it in with discussion about the next series, so if you're good, we're on, I don't know what slide this is, but it's the one that's Chen et al., Cancer Prevention Research, 2013, and you were just saying how the birth cohort for liver cancer has dropped essentially precipitously since
Okay, so I've lost my connectivity to my slides, so if somebody can control that would be...
Yep.
We got it covered.
Okay, so I think if you click, hopefully you get a red box that says perhaps 25% of individuals were vaccinated in the 80s.
Yes.
Okay, and the point I want to make here is that much of the drop in liver cancer rates occurs before any newborn was vaccinated. So we think that vaccination is not an important driver. Just click on the next one. We do acknowledge that young kids were vaccinated beginning in 2002. But again, most of the effect occurred in the absence of HPV vaccination. So perhaps a very different story than what was seen in Taiwan. So next slide. So if it's not HPV, then what about aflatoxins? aflatoxins represent significant contaminants in corn, maize, and peanuts, but not in rice. Next slide, you should be seeing a 1736 map of Chidong. It was mostly mudflats and water at that time. It is new land. While very fertile agricultural land, it was completely unsuitable for the cultivation of rice. So farmers there couldn't grow rice. Instead, they grew corn. Next slide. You should see a bright red map that shows the density of cultivation of rice throughout China. I want to highlight the little white peninsula there, Chidong, where no corn is grown. But if you look at the purple inset map, maize is indeed grown there. Next click, and you'll see a circle of denser corn cultivation as well, upriver, if you will. And then next slide, you'll see on our geographic pathology map that that's also a hotspot for the development of liver cancer. And that's perhaps not just a coincidence. Next slide. So what happened? Well, in the 1970s, the farmers there grew rice because of the social structure, the commune structure. There was no trading between communities of foodstuffs. Every community had to meet quotas. They grew locally. They ate locally. So people in that peninsula ate a lot of corn, over 100 kilograms a year of corn. That was their primary dietary staple. But in the middle 1980s, Deng Xiaoping introduced relaxation, if you will, to the social structure. Communes were abandoned. Market practices were introduced, at least gently. But this allowed farmers to still have to meet production quotas, but they could also put the better quality foods into the marketplace. And this prompted a very rapid shift in dietary staples from corn to rice. So what we have done very recently then is to go back through our archives of serum samples that have been collected over the almost 30 plus years now out of this region of China and provide a consistent LC mass spec based method of analysis for looking at aflatoxin albumin adducts in these people. Exposure levels were quite high in the 80s into the late 80s, where everybody had detectable levels of exposures to aflatoxin. But by the mid-1990s, these exposure levels dropped dramatically. We began to see less than 100% prevalence of positivity for the biomarkers. And by 2012, 93-94% of individuals are negative for these aflatoxin biomarkers, and those exposures that do exist are very, very low. So there's been about a 1,000-fold drop, we estimate, in aflatoxin exposures over the past couple of decades. Next click. You'll see that liver cancer mortality, based on China age standardized rate, has dropped upwards of 40% over this latter period of time, perhaps reflecting the consequences of diminished exposures to aflatoxin. Next clip shows our prediction of what's going to happen when HPV vaccination really exerts its full effect over the next couple of decades. And the optimists could predict that liver cancer is going to disappear from this community. Next click. However, I think the reality is that new risk factors are emerging with the economic development in Chidong and other parts of China have become obesity, significant increases in type 2 diabetes, fatty liver disease, NASH. So I fear that new risk factors are going to change the dynamics of what have been the successful would have been the successful mitigations of aflatoxin exposures and infection with hepatitis D virus. Next slide, bring us back to the United States just to remind us of what we already know, and that is obesity trends are increasing rapidly over the past couple of decades, perhaps stabilizing a little bit, but at inappropriately high levels. So again, we have to really worry about the new emerging changes. But we haven't solved all of our problems. In my last slide here, I just want to show you sort of current status of aflatoxin exposures around the globe. Over on the right, you can see the dramatic drop in China over three or four decades. That's the good news for public health. But if one looks at what's going on in Bangladesh, for example, and these are measures conducted by my colleague John Groopman at Johns Hopkins, we see sort of 1980 China levels in mothers and children in Bangladesh not too many years ago. Same in Mexico and other parts of Central America. And if we see what happened in Kenya, there were some acute aflatoxicoses where upwards of 125 farmers died from acute exposures to aflatoxins. Those exposures were at least a log higher than those that we're seeing in other parts of the world. So this is a problem that is still ongoing. We really know how to deal with the problem, but putting the public health measures into practice remains a challenge. And with that, I'll stop. Thank you very much.
Tom, thank you very much. And I know that it was rough when the phone system goes and leaves you. We have some time for some questions. So I have a question here. In the cohort study of liver cancer in China, did they adjust for other known risk factors of HCC, such as alcohol consumption or hepatitis C virus?
Yes, they did. Alcohol consumption is important in some regions of China, and certainly men are known to imbibe even in the Shanghai area. But that was adjusted for. HCV at present is very rare in China. I think that's going to change. And it is beginning to migrate up from Thailand, Cambodia, and the like into the southern tier of China. But at least in the Qidong area, as we've looked at it in the last year or two, very, very little infection with HCV to this point in time.
Thank you. Because of the... Okay. Yes, if there's anybody who wants to ask any questions on the phone, please do so. I've given you the instructions before, but we'll do it again, and that is take your phone off of mute by pressing #6, and you can remute your phone with pressing *6. And again, there's also the Q&A pod in the lower right-hand corner. I think that, you know, I've tracked and have been involved peripherally in these studies for many, many years of the interaction between aflatoxin and hepatitis B virus. And I do think that it is a significant model, a real model and a functional model for how to be able to understand the interaction between infectious agents, chemical exposures, in this case a specific chemical exposure, as well as individuals' genetics and predisposition. I think that this is also a model for how we are looking at other types of the role that chemicals and, in this case, viruses, but other infectious agents besides viruses, and was mentioned before by Dr. Rita LaCaruso with regards to bacteria, but we also have to take into consideration parasitic exposures as well in certain diseases. I don't know if you want to comment on parasites, but I think that they're very significant when you look at the number of people in the world who are exposed to parasitic diseases.
Well, certainly liver flukes contribute to increasing risks of liver cancer in Thailand and
right.
In other areas, and schistosomiasis and with regard to bladder cancer and the like. But in the context of the aflatoxin-HPV interaction story, I'd like to make two comments. One, I'd like to thank the generous support of NIHS over many decades, Bill. They really were the ones who drove this story. And the second factor that made this type of work possible was the development and validation of really good biomarkers
right.
of exposure and, in some cases, risk. And that's the key. You've got to know what your exposures are, and you've got to have tight analytical methods that allow you to measure them with high confidence of precision and reproducibility.
Yeah. I'm going to ask, there's going to be one more question because it's kind of a local question that is near and dear to everybody's heart here. In about 1985 or so in North Carolina and in other states in the U.S., there was trouble with aflatoxin. Did it have the same effect on the population of China I was one of the testers with the North Carolina Department of Agriculture. What is the status today? I don't know if you can, I don't know if you have the answer to that question. Because I'm not familiar with aflatoxin issues here in North Carolina or southern.
Yeah, certainly there have been episodic exposures in corn and groundnuts, peanuts in North Carolina, Georgia, corn out in the upper Midwest. And I think we do a better job of screening foodstuffs now for aflatoxin exposures. But every decade or so, we have what I'll call bad years in the U.S., where elements of our food crops are still rather heavily contaminated. And in theory, if those foods are engaged in interstate commerce, they get screened. And if the levels are above action levels, they should not be entered into interstate or intercountry commerce. They should be destroyed. So I think overall aflatoxin exposures are pretty low in the U.S. I think there's documented higher levels of exposure in some of the southern counties of Texas and along the Arizona-New Mexico border areas, where corn is just a much more dominant component of the diet. But by and large, I think the U.S. does a pretty good job of controlling aflatoxin exposures in most foodstuffs.
Okay, great. Dr. Kessler, thank you again for all your efforts. We're getting close to the witching hour, so I am going to conclude this session. But before we conclude, I want to make sure everybody is aware of the quote-unquote related URL pod, which contain the seminar resources and seminar feedback links. This is on your screen right now. On the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely so that you can access it after presentation. We place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack. So in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation that was given today. Also, in the, quote, related URLs pod, you will find an online seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms for these webinars. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's events. So there are new ways to connect. We would like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any webinars, and these are displayed here. For more information on EPA's Clue-In webinars, please refer to their website as well as all of the links that are here, and you can also find it through the Superfund research program link as well. Okay, so I mentioned before about the upcoming webinars that we have lined up for your, for you. One is coming up on October 31st. The other is on environmental chemicals and immune response. The other one is November 7th. Both of these are at 1 o'clock in the afternoon East Coast time. The November 7th one is going to look at the interaction between environmental exposures and infectious agents in the lung. If you have submitted an online question and we did not get to it, we will respond via email. If you have additional questions that you can also contact the presenters via email. Our email addresses are on the seminar homepage on Clue-In. Finally, and last but not least, seeing as how it is 4 o'clock, I would like to thank our presenters, Carl Weston, Rita LaCaruso, Jose Cordero, and Tom Kensler, for their time preparing and for sharing their presentations with us today. Thank you very much. And this concludes today's presentation. And thank you for your participation.